Well, thank you very much. Well, the whole history of the state, boy, I could spend all night talking about my favorite judge of all time, Stephen J. Field, who is, of course, the greatest judge California has ever produced and the only U.S. Supreme Court justice ever arrested for murder.
As much as you can say in 15 minutes.
Okay. Instead, what I'll say is that the original title for my paper was Moderately Extreme, which is how I see the California Supreme Court. I think that that the current court, a lot of people throw around terms like activism. I still am not really sure that activism means anything at all. And I think it tends to, usually it means that you disagree with the decision. And I think that the current judges think that also, because it's not so much activism that is going on with the California Supreme Court as the fact that they're simply in the grip of a progressive ideology that has dominated this state's political culture for many years. This progressive ideology has certain perspectives of how government works, what is the role of courts, what is the role of the legislature, and the members of the court grew up with that ideology, and they're just not inclined to question it. And some of those, and that also means that they're not really pioneers the way that some of the previous courts have been, like the Traynor Court or others, but it also means that they adhere to a vision of a political culture that is actually quite extreme. It's just that they're used to it, so they don't regard it as activist. Probably the most obvious example of that is the San Remo decision from a few years ago, when Justice Brown, arguing for some basic respect for property rights, the majority of the court attacked her for doing so on the grounds that the Constitution does not enact Robert Nozick's anarchy state in Utopia, which they thought was wonderfully clever, when all that she was arguing for was respect for individual rights to private property. And that is one of the core elements of the progressive ideology, of course, that it puts a great deal of emphasis on so-called privacy rights, personal rights, and has virtually no respect for economic freedom or private property rights. And so you can see that contrast in two cases. For example, you contrast Gentry versus Superior Court with, say, the marriage cases. Now, Gentry was a case in which the court went way out of its way to simply hold that a certain kind of contract waiving a person's right to sue as a class action was virtually per se illegal. Why? Because they don't like those kinds of contracts. That's it, really. Or the Quick Take case. I can't remember the name of it now, but do you even know what Quick Take is? It's a procedure under eminent domain that says that the government can take your property now, deposit what it estimates your property to be worth in a bank account controlled by the court, and then take immediate possession of your property. Then they can do what they want with your property, and later you have your hearing over whether or not they have the right to take your property, right? And in California, if you want to challenge the government's right to take your property, you're not allowed to touch the money. You touch the money, you waive your right to sue over their right to take your property, which is, in my view, blatantly a violation of the Due Process Clause, but the California Supreme Court says it's perfectly all right. So that's an example of how this court really does not have any respect for private property rights. And the same for economic freedom, which is unfortunate because, as we all know, Justice William O. Douglas, that vast right-wing conspirator, said that the right to earn a living was, quote, the most precious liberty man possesses, unquote. And another element of this progressive ideology is the ideas of democracy, and I want to put that in quotation marks. Democracy is more important than liberty as a constitutional value. That was one of the core components of the progressive movement. Now, democracy, they did not actually mean the will of the people. They meant electoral majorities or the outcome of a bureaucratic procedure that supposedly spoke the will of the people, and in reality, rarely actually has anything in common with the will of the people. But nevertheless, elevates what they consider democracy to be above liberty, and interprets rights as being basically permissions that can be revoked by the government to suit whatever the government desires to do. Now, as you can see, there is an inherent conflict between that view and the view that certain personal privacy rights should be inherently protected, right? The two do not go together. They're inherently in contradiction. And that's one of the reasons that you find sort of a schizophrenic outcome from these court decisions is because the California Supreme Court believes in an ideology that is incoherent. I will take a quick look at the marriage cases and say one of the unfortunate things about the marriage cases that I think people have not really emphasized enough is that the marriage cases did not legalize gay marriage in California. Gay marriage was substantively already legal in California. What the marriage cases say is that you can't call same-sex marriage by any other name than marriage, because the state owes equal dignity to the to the private arrangements, the family arrangements of individuals. Why it doesn't owe equal dignity to their employment contracts or to their right to purchase or sell property is, of course, left unanswered. And really, they had to reach out for that issue in the marriage cases. And if they reached out for that issue, in order to seem bold, they did so in contradiction to the progressive idea that democracy should triumph, right? I mean, if democracy should triumph, they should have ruled the other way in the marriage cases. Well, the answer is they don't always believe that democracy should triumph. They do believe in protecting important individual rights. But, of course, the word important does a lot of work there. Important means the rights that they consider important. So the bottom line is that it's not the court that's extreme, it's the ideology that is extremely alienated from the foundations of American political culture. And I know that that's kind of an extreme thing to say, but it's true. The progressive ideology has virtually nothing in common with the views expressed, at least by the American founding. And unfortunately, we live with that legacy today. I think a few of the other weaknesses of the problems that the court faces are the fact that they have such a crushing caseload. I'm sure Professor Uhlman will get into this a little bit more, that they're so busy. And we're talking about a court of 7 people that oversees a state of 30 million people. And every day that goes by, I am more and more persuaded that California has no business being a single state. I'm from Southern California, and I moved up here about 5 years ago, and it is a different world up here. It just is. I like it better up here. But, you know, there's no sense in Sacramento dictating terms of law and politics to the people of Los Angeles. But that's a debate for another day. Anyway, they have an enormous workload and not enough personnel or the capacity to handle it. And the other problem is that, unfortunately, the state courts get too little press coverage. Everybody pays attention to the U.S. Supreme Court, especially in the summertime when they're issuing their really controversial decisions. But there's not usually very much coverage over the state courts, and especially the state Supreme Court, except in a case like the marriage cases or something. But I think that's unfortunate because, obviously, at least under the Federalist system, the state Supreme Court is supposed to have more effects over our lives, back when federalism was fashionable. However, I think that the tide on that is changing also. I'm glad to say that Chapman University Law School down in Orange County has started to publish an annual Supreme Court review. I'm proud of that because they are my alma mater. So I think that will help a lot. I think to have something that will cover exclusively the California Supreme Court the way that other states already have had is going to help a great deal. So that's what I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Very much, and Tim, you're invited to Bob's next editorial meeting to get those stories on the California Supreme Court moved up to A1. Our next speaker is Professor Jerry Uhlman. If you have a good memory, you may remember during the O.J. Simpson trial, there was a very handsome, bespeckled, mustachioed lawyer behind the defense table, and that was indeed Jerry Uhlman. Professor Uhlman is a great scholar of criminal law in particular, and also in addition to his distinguished scholarship, but also is a noted commentator on the California Supreme Court. He also has in his biography something that I think is profoundly interesting, which is he authored a one-actor play on the life of Williams Jennings Bryan. So after we're done, I'm sure Professor Uhlman will be happy to do either selections from The Cross of Gold speech or moments from Johnny Cochran's closing in the O.J. Simpson trial. in any event, we are very much honored to have Professor Yulman here, and he's next in our lineup talking about the conference. Of course, Professor Yulman.
I recommend reading the Crossicle speech. It's just a marvelous read. Listening to the presidential debate the other night, the reference to the trickle-down theory of the economy, that was originated by William Jennings Bryan in the Crossicle speech. He was the first one to use that phrase, the trickle-down economy. I like to think of the California Supreme Court as a mirror image of the United States Supreme Court. On the U.S. Supreme Court now, we have four justices who lean to the right and four who lean to the left. And when the court splits, whichever way it's going to come out is dependent on how Justice Kennedy sees it. And that's quite significant in the U.S. Supreme Court because in 30% of their cases, they do split 5-4. And Justice Kennedy, of course, doesn't always lean the same way. So it's fun to watch. But the California Supreme Court is equally fun to watch in the same way, although they don't split down the middle as often as the United States Supreme Court. In the last year, they only split in 8 of 107 cases. But you do have 3 justices who lean right and 3 who lean left. And the way the case comes out will depend on how Chief Justice Ron George votes. I always tell lawyers preparing to argue a case in the California Supreme Court that if you want to win, you've got to convince the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice for the last 3 years now has produced 0 dissenting votes. He has ruled with the court majority in every decision. Many of the decisions of the California Supreme Court, however, are unanimous. There is no dissenting vote at all. Last year, 86 of their 107 cases were unanimous. So 80% of the output of the California Supreme Court is in unanimous opinions. The dissent rate has really been declining dramatically on the California Supreme Court. With the disappearance of Stanley Mosk, who at one point was dissenting in 42% of the cases, with the replacement of Janice Rogers Brown, who was dissenting pretty consistently in about 15% of the cases. Today, the overall dissent rate on the California Supreme Court is down to 5.4%. That means of all the votes cast in all of the cases, only 5.4% are dissenting votes. So this is a court that is pretty much in agreement most of the time. But when they do split, Chief Justice George determines the outcome as he did in the marriage cases, as he did in the Fashion Valley Mall case, which I think was one of the most significant decisions of the past year. You may recall that one of Stanley Mosk's landmark opinions was the Pruneyard case, in which the court held that a young group of schoolboys could collect signatures on a petition at the Pruneyard Shopping Center despite the Pruneyard's rules against petition circulators coming into the mall. Justice Mosk reasoned that today what used to be the public street has become the shopping mall. That's where everybody gathers. That's where you go if you want to circulate a petition. That decision was, of course, based on the California state constitution, and it's kind of a monument of the independence of the California state constitution. Fashion Valley Mall, by a 4-3 vote, the court stuck to its ruling in Prunyard and upheld the right of union picketers to urge a boycott of a store in the shopping mall on the property of the shopping mall. The independence of the state constitution has been very much in decline in California because of the enactment in 1982 of Proposition 8. Proposition 8, as you might recall, amended the state constitution to say that we cannot exclude relevant evidence in a criminal case in California. And of course, exclusionary rules do precisely that. We have to follow the decisions of the United States Supreme Court with regard to the exclusionary rules. But in recent years, the United States Supreme Court has not been particularly friendly to the exclusionary rule, and they're looking for ways to trim it. And we've seen some remarkable opinions in recent years. And many of those opinions have been rejected by Supreme Courts in other states, relying on their state constitution to say, for example, we're not going to recognize a good faith exception as the Supreme Court created in Leon. That has not been an option for California. That is, we have to march in lockstep with the United States Supreme Court when it comes to the exclusionary rules. And the California Supreme Court was actually, at the time Prop 8 was enacted, in the front ranks of state Supreme Courts that were using their state constitution to give greater protection to criminal defendants under the Constitution. When Prop 8 was enacted, 50 decisions of the California Supreme Court, many of them authored by Stanley Mosk, were abrogated and no longer in effect. And since Prop 8, we haven't seen a lot of the state constitution in criminal decisions and very rarely in civil decisions as well. So it was great for me. I'm a great fan of the independence of the state constitution. To see it come back to the fore this past year in both the Fashion Valley Mall case and the marriage cases, because the marriage cases very clearly are based on a interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause of the California Constitution that is much broader than the interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause in the United States Constitution. By ruling that sexual orientation is a suspect class, the court has shifted the burden of proof, and now any discrimination against anyone on the basis of their sexual orientation will be presumptively unconstitutional. And the state will have to show compelling circumstances to justify it. Despite all of that, I think the California Supreme Court is basically still a conservative, pro-business court. One of the research attorneys at the California Supreme Court published an article last year in which they actually counted up the number of decisions of the California Supreme Court that have been followed by other state Supreme Courts, and came to the not surprising conclusion that the California Supreme Court is the most followed Supreme Court of any state court in the country. And Jake Deere, who did the study, broke it down in terms of the Byrd Court, the Lucas Court, the George Court, the Traynor Court, and it turns out the highest rate of followed decisions was the Lucas Court. When the court turned to a more conservative agenda, it was very much in step with what was happening in the U.S. Supreme Court, what was happening in other state Supreme Courts, and became a very followed court. What surprises me, though, is even though I think our court is very much in step with the U.S. Supreme Court and really makes an effort, I think, to stay in step, is that they do have a worse record than the Ninth Circuit when their decisions are reviewed by the United States Supreme Court. They've had four reversals in the last 5 years, and the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't review a lot of state Supreme Court decisions anymore. So that's a rather remarkable record. And what's especially remarkable about it is that in all four of these decisions, the California Supreme Court had ruled against a defendant in a criminal case and was then reversed by the United States Supreme Court, ruling in favor of the defendant. These cases involved extending the statute of limitations for child molesters after the prior statute of limitations had elapsed. And the court in Stodner said, the U.S. Supreme Court said that violates the ex post facto clause. The Cunningham decision with regard to the applicability of Blakely versus Washington to the California sentencing law. Last term, the Gremlin decision, in which our court said that passengers in an automobile stopped by the police don't have standing to object to the stop because they were not seized. And the United States Supreme Court reversed that one unanimously. And then this past year, in the Giles case, with respect to the breadth of the forfeiture exception to the right of confrontation. If there's any Achilles heel, I think, on the California Supreme Court, it's in the area of their death penalty jurisprudence. The death penalty is kind of like the sword of Damocles hanging over the heads of the court, because as the backlogs have grown, they have assumed the proportion of being an insoluble problem. I don't think that the court can ever dig itself out of the hole that it is now in. In California, we have the longest death row in the country. We have 674 inmates on death row in San Quentin. As was mentioned, we've only had 13 executions. The leading cause of death on death row is death by natural causes, followed by suicide, followed by execution. We have 219 people who have been on death row for more than 15 years. The average lapse now for California between the time of sentence and the time of execution is 24 years. The national average is 12 years. So we are now at double the national average. A lot of the backlog, of course, is in getting lawyers appointed to handle the direct appeals and the habeas. But even when lawyers are appointed and diligently brief the cases, there is a huge backlog in the court itself in having the case heard. The California Supreme Court right now has 80 fully briefed death penalty cases on its docket. And that means when you've written all your briefs and turned them in, you have about a 3-year wait before you will have oral argument in the case. When it comes to habeas petitions, the court's backlog is 100 fully briefed habeas petitions right now. When these cases get into federal court with the federal habeas, at this point now, the federal courts have completed their review of 56 California death judgments. They have reversed 38 of them. So that means decisions that have been upheld by the California Supreme Court on both direct appeal and state habeas are being overturned in the federal courts at a 70% rate. I recently served as executive director for a state commission on the fair administration of justice that took a hard look at the death penalty. We issued our final report on June 1st of this year and expressed agreement with Chief Justice George that the death penalty in California is dysfunctional. And I have to express admiration for Chief Justice George in taking the initiative to do something about it. He's proposed a constitutional amendment to allow the court to transfer fully briefed death cases to the courts of appeal for the initial decision. The court is considering a proposal by Judge Allerton of the Ninth Circuit that the habeas hearings should take place in the Superior Court rather than in the Supreme Court and follow the natural progression of review through the California judicial system. I think the backlog, in part, can be blamed on the court itself, because throughout the 1990s, when the court was getting as many as 40 or 45 new death judgments every year, the Supreme Court never even intimated that that was any problem. Chief Justice Lucas, I think, went through his entire tenure with his head in the sand with regard to the problem of the death penalty. It was never even acknowledged as being a problem. And I think it's good news that we've gotten past that with Chief Justice George. So with that, I'll let you move on to our final speaker.
Thank you very much, Professor Yulman. Our next speaker is someone who I've admired for many years, first because he was the head of the chapter in Sacramento, which for a long time was a model to our chapter, and his leadership there was really a model to how we try to conduct the business of our chapter, and that's Tom Getty. Tom is fortunately now splitting his time between Sacramento and San Francisco to the benefit of our fair city here by the Bay. Tom, before he was with the Bingham McCutcheon firm, spent almost 2 decades with the California Attorney General's office. He rose there to be a key policy advisor and staff counsel to Attorney General Dan Lundgren, and his ability and wisdom was so apparent that after General Lundgren moved on from being Attorney General, even General Lockyer recognized those qualities and continued to rely on Tom in a senior capacity to advise him. Tom has appeared both before the United States Supreme Court and the State Supreme Court on numerous occasions. He's going to give us his insights into the California Supreme Court from his perspective as a former Deputy Attorney General and as a practicing lawyer.
Thank you, David, and I apologize in advance for a rather disjointed and ad hoc presentation. It doesn't have any particular clean theme to it. but that to some degree might reflect my perception of the California Supreme Court. Not that everything that comes out of it is ad hoc, but there is a question, I think, sometimes of whether there is a theme, whether you can really perceive the trend this way or the trend that way. And sometimes you do get the sense that, oh, this is a court leaning to the left or this is a court leaning to the right. And it is hard sometimes to pin that down, and it sometimes hangs on individual justices, not just the Chief Justice. It sometimes is the Chief Justice's court, but as the professor has said, that's often because the Chief Justice has simply gone along with the majority in all cases. Maybe he's fashioned the majority in those cases. Hard to say, but he is not your dissenter. He's not Janice Rogers Brown. So it's really hard to put your finger on this. This isn't quite like how you characterize the trends in the U.S. Supreme Court. I would wonder out loud and think out loud about whether this is about leadership or timidity. I happen to agree with Professor Uhlman about Prop 8. I was a prosecutor at the time that wanted Prop 8. I remember the days when voir dire to get a jury impaneled would take days and days and days, and the opportunity to match it to the federal system made a lot of sense because we were able then to get voir dire done and get on with the case, and by lunch break interview your last witness and the judge would have you on and the jury was impaneled. In retrospect, I just my own personal perspective is I'm a federalist. I'm a federalist at heart, and having lost the opportunity for the court to rely on independent state constitutional grounds is, in my view, a loss. Even when the state Supreme Court might use those independent state constitutional grounds in a leftward direction to advance certain social policies or the like, I'm still a federalist. I want that balance between the opportunity, or the balance between the state courts and the federal courts to be perpetuated and not just always default, as Prop 8 does, to the federal rule. In fact, I want to see more state Supreme Court justices appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think anybody has been appointed since Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who is the senior judge of the Intermediate State Court of Appeal in Arizona. And since everybody seems to have this notion that whoever goes to the United States Supreme Court has to be a federal judge and have a black robe in the federal system, no offense to our federal judges, but it strikes me that there is some value in having the perspective of a state court Supreme Court justice or intermediate court appellate justice serve on the United States Supreme Court to lend that kind of perspective. On the other hand, timidity, I don't know, you know, the United States Supreme Court has been willing on occasion to reverse itself and overrule its earlier opinions. And I've not seen that from Chief Justice George. And in fact, Pruneyard decision, Fashion Valley Mall. Thank you. I commend to you Justice Chin's dissent in which he marches through in detail and probably as comprehensively as I've ever seen a good understanding of the property law and free expression interests that I've read anywhere, in which he points out that no other court is following Pruneyard, that if there may be many Lucas Court opinions that are followed by other courts in South Dakota and Nevada and elsewhere, but Pruneyard isn't one of them. And the years go by in which it has less and less traction in every place in the country except California, and the majority in the opinion says, oh, no, this is precedent. It's, it's the California way, the California view. And I just think that is an expression of timidity in the court as a whole to leave it there. And Justice Chin did an outstanding service to the court. I mean, you look at the United States Supreme Court in Seminole Tribe versus State of Florida being willing to overturn Union Gas, even though their understanding of the Interstate Commerce Clause for years had been predicated on the ability of Congress to abrogate state sovereign immunity and out of the Constitution and express that in union gas. And the Supreme Court looked at it again and said, we've taken a look at it again. And now it occurs to us that no Article I power really justifies the abrogation of 11th Amendment immunity. Now, you can argue on and on about whether Hens versus Louisiana was correctly or incorrectly decided, but the court was willing to stand up and be courageous about that point and overrule one of their earlier precedents. And so I'm just not so sure that the California Supreme Court, the George Court, if you want to call that, is expressing leadership or not expressing leadership. For those of you who saw the California Bar Journal article by Clark Kelso, my friend, I teach at McGeorge Federal Indian Law, a little niche out there, and Clark and I go way back. But after he discusses the in-ray marriage cases, he said that there's no doubt that the majority decision pushed the ball down the field a little further than the California Constitution necessarily required. But that, after all, is what leadership is all about. This is what differentiates a great court from other courts, a court that is a full participant with all the other branches of government and with the people in developing more mature understandings and interpretations of constitutional provisions. Well, I would take issue with my friend Clark on a couple of things. I'm not sure that it's leadership. If you follow and subscribe to at least some of what the dissent, Justice Baxter's dissent and Justice Corrigan's dissent is, that this belongs, the province of deciding these issues belongs with the legislature and not with the court. The court shouldn't be arrogating these decisions to itself. I guess you could take issue that that is leadership, usurpation and arrogation of power is leadership in one sense, but not all senses. And then for his suggestion that the court is a full participant with the other branches of government, I think we'll see that on Election Day when Prop 8 is facing off against in-ray marriage cases, whether you're for it or against it. I'm just going to the question of where do the branches of power here lie, and I'm not sure it is leadership. So it was courageous, perhaps, and it was dramatic, perhaps, but I'm not sure that... You know, I didn't really think that I would be the one in this panel that would be, end up talking about in-ray marriage cases. It wasn't my case. I had no real particular interest in it. It wasn't an issue for me particular. I was much more interested in discussing the death penalty case, and I'd like to get to that. But I might as well just jump into briefly in-ray marriage cases, because it is one of those decisions where I didn't have a strong opinion one way or the other before I went to it. To read it, and or as a court of appeal decision, and then subsequently the Supreme Court decision, which I only read as of late. This wasn't a big issue that I was following, but I am now as equivocal on it as I was before I really studied it, because I thought that the majority opinion was fairly tight on the equal protection analysis and strict scrutiny as to the classification of sexual orientation. And I thought it was very loose as to the question of marriage. And whether the two tie together well or not, I really don't know. I read Justice Baxter and Justice Corrigan's dissents, and I'm sometimes convinced and sometimes not convinced. It has eluded me a little bit, and aside from my own personal views about the issue, I just think that it's a decision I'm going to have to sit on for a while and scratch my head about, and I think that's actually what the public is going to do as well, and we'll see what happens with Prop 8. Let me just look, just to share with you briefly, why I think the reasoning that the Chief Justice used was fairly tight as to this question of sexual orientation, and I apologize for reading, but as he addresses the question of meeting the statutory classification to be suspect for the equal protection under the state constitution purposes, he points to three requirements that have to be met under well-established California law. One, that it be based on an immutable trait. Two, bear no relation to a person's ability to perform or contribute to society. and three, be associated with a stigma of inferiority and second-class citizenship. And the court points out quite readily that the latter two are easily met. The first one, immutable trait, ends up being one of those arguments that was before the court and the court struggles with, and the court points to religion isn't an immutable trait. People can change their religion, and other characteristics may not be immutable as we understand them in that. What's really here is important is that it is not appropriate to require a person to repudiate or change his or her sexual orientation in order to avoid discriminatory treatment. And I think that's probably a pretty compelling way to respond to the immutability question. The Attorney General actually walked up and said there's a fourth category you ought to consider as well. The Attorney General was in a very odd position in coming before the court in this one. But and that was that that a fourth requirement should be required, and that is that a suspect classification should only be recognized for minorities who are unable to use the political process to address their needs. And now you've got a real debate on your hands. Is the political process really available? Is it not available for those of a different sexual orientation? And that's hardly, I mean, it's almost not justiciable. I mean, it's just one of those questions that you have to kind of struggle with. Certainly, the gay and lesbian community has considerable political clout. They have access in the political system. And so you end up having to struggle with whether that's true or not true. The Supreme Court, in the majority opinion, says that's really not dispositive, and they really don't let it hang on the question of a group's current political powerlessness and just whether there's powerlessness in general. I think it's kind of a weak spot, but, you know, it was the fourth point that the Attorney General wanted to drag into the case in the first place. So you've got at least some considerable California jurisprudence that the majority puts together on the suspect classification status under the state equal protection jurisprudence that pretty tight, actually. It worked pretty well. The real question is, how does this relate to marriage and the statute that defines marriage as between being a man and a woman? And you could argue quite readily, I think, that the statute really isn't about restricting anybody's sexual orientation. The court said that's just kind of facile analysis. It would be inappropriate to suggest that that a statute that clearly, actually, that the statute can't be seen any other way than to restrict same-sex couples, and so. That's how they kind of tie it together. And I don't know, maybe that works, maybe it doesn't work. Justice Corrigan and Justice Baxter both hang quite a bit on separation of powers and that the court is arrogating to itself the determination of these kinds of issues that would normally be more appropriate for the legislature or by initiative to the people. I struggle with that one, too, because I thought it was the purpose of in applying the Equal Protection Clause that it serves as a check on the legislative branch when the legislative branch is trampling on the rights of minorities and those who would otherwise be protected under the whole point of the Equal Protection Clause. And so I'm not sure I buy that one terribly. Justice Corrigan even argues as to race, which, you know, the miscegenation law was at issue, she points to how the Constitution was actually amended in the Civil War amendments, and that later, in order to overcome the Jim Crow laws, the Civil Rights laws were enacted in 1964 and 1968 to overcome those things. The courts also stepped in, and they used the Equal Protection Clause. So I struggle with that one a little bit, too. I'm not quite sure that Justice Baxter and Justice Corrigan's dissents on that basis really apply. Is this arrogation of power? or is this an appropriate check using the Equal Protection Clause? I don't know. I'm going to keep scratching my head. And I guess the thing that bothers me the most is it really is a battle about a label. And as Tim said earlier, they come to the notion that the label that's involved in the word marriage has to afford equal dignity, and this is all about using that word, when in fact the family union for same-sex couples is perfectly available and well-protected under California law. So you've got institutions that are essentially exactly the same, except marriage as a word, as a definition, is now presumed to be given equal dignity. It's a interesting direction for the court to go in, and I'm going to keep thinking about it. Prop 8 will tell us a little bit more too where the public is. And as Professor Uhlman has said, there will be challenges after Prop 8 as well, and we'll see how those get reconciled as well. Am I running out of time, or can I say a little bit on the death penalty?
Sure, sure. And then we'll start with some questions.
Sure. Just from the perspective as a former Deputy Attorney General, I've seen the length and complexity and the delays in the death penalty system I handled in 1980s. Three death penalty cases, all of which are still in federal habeas corpus and awaiting and in arguments over what's a successive petition, and these are cases that preceded the enactment of some federal law that was supposed to expedite federal habeas review, but they predated it, and so it is astonishing to see the incredible backup and delay. I disagree with Professor Uhlman a little bit here about who to blame backlog on. I'm not sure you can blame the California Supreme Court for all this backlog and that the Chief Justice Lucas had his head in the sand on it. I think that the Supreme Court, California Supreme Court, has had a traditional understanding of how to approach collateral review or state habeas challenges, and that their fairly summary or dismissive denials of habeas review have been based on how they've understood the issues that are tendered in the petitions, typically involving allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial, or additional evidence, new evidence that wasn't brought up at trial, didn't have merit. As a consequence of sort of rethinking this through, we've now gotten to the point where state habeas corpus review and federal habeas corpus review have become new trials, whole new follow-on trials to the original trial for all those issues that couldn't have been brought up at trial, or if it relates to the ineffective assistance of counsel at trial, are a grant of another trial. It just sort of never ends, and I think that that's one reason why the federal Congress passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act in 1996, I think. Presumably, that stuff would move along in the federal system a little faster, but it hasn't. And what I can say, though, is that two final points, and that is, I would commend Chief Justice George for his proposal to get the death penalty appeals heard at the State Court Intermediate Court of Appeal with subsequent review by the State Supreme Court. I think there will be plenty of measures in the proposal. This would be a state constitutional amendment to ensure the fair administration of justice. And then secondly, to allow the trial courts at the Superior Court to start with the state habeas to build a record. I fear a little bit that all that will be doing is building a whole new system for extended re-examination of every single criminal death penalty case, so that we end up not with one trial and one appeal and potentially some habeas corpus review, but just an endless stream and string of review after review after review of new factual allegations, of new assertions, and new claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And if that's the case, then the Supreme Court will be facing 750 people on death row, and none of them will move. So, again, I apologize for the ad hoc, non-thematic approach, but I think that's what you're getting out of the California Supreme Court.
Thank you, Tom. And in economically unclear times, we can all, as lawyers, take away some solace in the fact that the current state of the death penalty will help to keep lawyers employed for the foreseeable future in the state. We've got some time to take a few questions from the panelists. Judge Walker.
I want a direct question to Bob Majelka. Most people, with the exception of law professors and others who are particularly interested, obtain their information about what courts do by reading you and others who report on the courts. And you read decisions of all kinds of courts, from the United States Supreme Court all the way down. And you followed the California Supreme Court for a long period of time. My question is this. How does the California Supreme Court compare in the craftsmanship of its opinions vis-a-vis other courts in explaining the rationale of its decisions? And how has that craftsmanship changed over the period of time that you observed the California Supreme Court? Do they do a better job now or a less good job? And do they do a better or less good job than other courts?
Thank you. Well, I think they lost maybe their best writer when Justice Brown left the D.C. Circuit. They're long. The opinions are awfully long, too long. In some respects, I don't think the Merritt case was too long because there were many bases to cover. I mean, in addition to equal protection, we had privacy and there were lengthy dissents and all that. But there were routine cases that stretch on for 80 or 90 pages, and every death penalty case goes, 90, 100 odd pages. I guess it's hard to really characterize the work of the California Supreme Court. When we had Justice Kaufman was an excellent, pithy writer. Chief Justice George tends to, go to some length. And there's always the question of who's really writing this stuff. How much of it is staff written and how much of it is the justice. And I know Professor Barnett or Ted Bowles has written about this a fair amount and said that the court is far too dependent on its staff and the justices don't take a firm enough editorial hand. But I guess it's for the most part, with Justice Brown's departure, it's hard to think of a phrasemaker there, someone who you'll quote a few months occasionally. Justice Kennard, in one of her short dissents or concurrences, will speak her mind, as she, if you've attended any oral arguments, does at some length from the bench. And you'll go away with that. But just in terms of sheer writing quality and expression and ability to convey your thoughts to the public, I don't think that this court is supreme in its writing as much as sometimes in its thinking or in its ability to cut through a lot of fog, as I think they did, for example, in the marriage case. One of the things that made the marriage case particularly a joy to write about was the way they put it, the way they brought a lot of these arguments that had been made at such length in other courts from Judge Kramer and the Superior Court to read different separate opinions in the Court of Appeal, and then all of a sudden, all of these arguments about autonomy, privacy, about equal protection, about the separation of powers were put before us in
despite their length, relatively concise ways that really frame the issue for the public or for the press. It was kind of thrilling to actually be able to sit down, underline those words, and then with the other half of your mind say, your Hitler history is being made. And this quote was up to the task. Whether its conclusion was the proper one is certainly something that I'm neither qualified nor appropriately situated to say. But they issued a decision, I guess, as monumental as the subject was, both in the majority and in the dissent. I guess I really haven't thought too much about how it's changed over time, only to think that there were some memorable writers, Justice Mosk, I mean, I'm thinking of the phrase that he wrote when the court upheld Prop 8 about the goddess of justice weeps today, or wears a black arm band today as she weeps for the Constitution of California. Probably won't see too much of that stated in too many of the sometimes you'll see it on the U.S. Supreme Court, maybe because they tend to think in grander terms, Justice Scalia will write that way, or Justice Kennedy. And maybe this court doesn't quite take itself as seriously as all that, knowing that it isn't the final word. Even in the marriage case, for all the complaints about judicial activism and narrating to itself and all that, there's a vote coming up next month to see whether that's the last word. And there's a vote in a couple years to see whether the justices who wrote the opinions, those of them who are on the ballot, belong in the court still. And perhaps that term enters a measure of, I don't know, humility or some, or maybe it's just the nature of the current court, the tendency for them to not write in such grand sweeping phrases and speak in such eternal verities. At least I don't think that this court does that.
Perhaps a life tenure would help the writing style. Larry Callahan.
Yeah. I want to get back to the death penalty. Those numbers are very, very high, and I've noted that in other articles when I've read them. But no one sits and compares them to Texas. I suspect they're not as high. But if you take about the life expectancy, the number of years it takes from conviction to appeal to federal and state habeas, what's it like in New York? What's it like in Illinois? Are the figures pretty much the same? We are the largest state in the country population-wise. What happens in other large states and small states? Are they fairly similar?
The national average is 12 years. Texas is right at the national average. No, Texas is 12 years. They have almost 400 people on their death row. Florida is number three. New York no longer has a death penalty. The court of appeals of New York struck it down, and the legislature has not been able to muster a majority to fix it.
What about Illinois?
Illinois, Governor Ryan
cleared off
death row.
That's right.
So they've solved their problem. And New Jersey solved their problem this last year. They actually abolished the death penalty in New Jersey. The legislature did, and the governor signed it.
I have a question, and this is addressed to everybody. And particularly Tim's point about the court being in it's taking on the sort of progressivism that's been throughout California history. Do each of you see this court as somehow fitting in a continuum of the court in its role in California over time, or you see this court in a discontinuity that it's going off in a different direction, that's doing something new? Brief thoughts on that. Let me start. I'll hand this to Tim.
Well, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure how to answer that, because I think one of the themes that we've heard tonight is that there isn't really a core of ideological ground that makes it easy to make such a determination. I think that in a sense the answer is that they're within the boundaries of traditional California political culture. I mean, California is one of the places where progressive ideology flourished, right? The initiative and the recall and Howard and Johnson and the whole thing. And the court has generally been in that tradition all along. I do think that it is true. I think one thing that was said was that this court has been pro-business. And I think that it's careful. You have to be careful to distinguish pro-business from pro-freedom. It's true that the court has backtracked, I think, clearly. The Leaders Court and the current court has backtracked from some of the more outlandish tort theories that were adopted by the Byrd Court and some of the predecessors. But it has not been willing to think about things in fundamental terms. Remember, progressivism is the political expression of pragmatism, and pragmatism taught us all that we don't have to think in principles. So, which makes it very difficult for lawyers whose job it is to think in principles. And so what we end up doing is talking instead about people or about identity politics. And that's why we see the current election going the way that it is. We don't have any discussion over fundamental principles about concepts such as freedom or a term that apparently no longer is even used in campaign speeches. Instead, we talk about my group versus your group, and this group versus that group, and who's going to be appointed, and that sort of thing. And so it becomes a tug of war, which is basically a civilized form of civil war, where each public interest, each pressure group, uses its opportunity in the legislature to extract wealth and opportunities from its enemies. And of course, public choice theory teaches us that not only will legislative majorities use their opportunities to legislate in their own favor, but they will seek that constitutional order which expands their opportunity for doing so. And so, if necessary, they will simply ignore all provisions of the Constitution in order to expand their opportunity to redistribute wealth and opportunities. Hence, the abolition of substantive due process theory in the 1930s. So that we could establish the regulatory welfare state. Well, California was all on board with that, and they remain on board with that.
I think this court, much more than the Byrd Court or the Lucas Court, sees itself as part of the California body politic, where the previous two courts, I think, by and large, had definite views of the role of the justices standing against, if need be, the popular will, or standing against the excesses of a previous court. I mean, even in the marriage case, which is a rare example of the George Court overturning a law, they were very conscious and said so of the expressions of the public will through the legislature, having enacted domestic partner laws, having enacted and requiring domestic partners to get a whole variety of equal rights in parenting, in business, in housing, and so forth. And the legislature having twice passed bills to legalize same-sex marriage, to have them vetoed by the governor on very plausible grounds that an initiative of prohibited it. But nonetheless, the court was aware and said so, that this is where public policy already was. And it made it very difficult for the court to find a rationale, regardless of whether it was strict scrutiny or a lesser degree of scrutiny, to justify continued discrimination as it viewed it. But I think the court does that in a whole range of cases. And because of the Chief Justice, the governors who made the appointments and the priorities that they had at the time, and the character of these judges, and maybe just the culture that permeates the court, is this court very much sees itself as sort of part of the California milieu, the culture, and one that will not stray too far from where either the political branches or the will of the public are. And of course, if they do, there's the public out there ready to tell them so.
I think state Supreme Courts generally reflect the population of the states that they serve. It's no accident that the most liberal state Supreme Courts are New Jersey and New York, and the most conservative are Texas and Mississippi. We have red states and blue states, and I think we have red courts and blue courts. California is a very blue state. If anything, I think the court is probably more conservative than the population of the state that it represents. But I'll tell you one thing. Chief Justice George has his finger on the pulse. I don't think we would have seen the marriage decision come out the way it did if he was not confident that if it's put to a vote
it's going to come out the other way. But public opinion has swung dramatically on this issue since the 2003 initiative. And I think Chief Justice George foresaw that if put to a vote, the public would accept the decision that he rendered. And I think that's going to be borne out.
I agree with pretty much everything that has been said. I think the court has been deferential and timid. I think they defer to the agencies, the government, they defer to public opinion, and even as I think the professor just said, I think all the more they did in remarriage cases is not exercise some sort of measure of courage as sort of had their finger in the air and knew where the political wind was going to be and deferred to it. So, again, I think timid and deferential.
Bill, it's just past 7:30. What I'm going to propose is that if you have some questions, maybe the panelists stick around for a couple minutes. But let's end the formal portion of our program now. And I want to thank all of our panelists for their insights. I think everyone here who doesn't normally practice in front of that court really learned a lot tonight, and you know, the scope of their work is just so vast that it's really, I think that it is very difficult to sort of place a jurisprudential stamp on a court. That being said, it doesn't mean that it's not worth the effort to try to analyze what they do, and we appreciate your efforts to do that in your work. And we're grateful for your insights this evening. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. If anyone isn't sure if they're on this chapter's mailing list, please slip me a card and I'll make sure that you get on it. Other than that, portion of our program is done. Stick around for some conversation if you wish, and the food and wine is still available for a little while. So thank you all very much.
No. I really enjoyed it.